Succession number 28416, Reel 2.
Bill, can you just repeat to which squadron you were pasted?
Yes. Having arrived at... where did we dismount? Oh, we got off at Valletta, of course, and went ashore there. What was the point?
You did mention the squadron that you joined when you were...
Which one was it?
Good.
I should mention, while we were waiting in Alexandria for this trip up there, we stayed with the 230 Squadron, which was based at Alexandria, with flying boats, of course. And they lived on board a ship, actually, in the harbour, the crew, all the crews. And we slept in with them, which was jolly nice. So we learned a little bit more about the 230s there, and here's the fleet, and we're getting a picture of what's going on around us. And... So we left our 230 Squadron ship, which had a name which they remember because it sailed around the whole world, really, looking after them all the more. And when we got to Valletta, first thing went straight to Califrana, which is 228 Squadron, Sunderland's again.
Now
I should have mentioned that whilst out in Alexandria, I mentioned it earlier, whilst being in Egypt, I should have been thinking of my brother then. I think I did, because we had to go to get some clothes to wear, actually, because they didn't have tailoring in Salisbury, Rhodesia. And we went to a Greek tailor in Alexandria for kitting out. And then I should have thought of my brother, who was there also somewhere. I didn't, not till later. However, 228 Squadron. Well, there was a funny thing happened there. When we were called in to see the group captain of Califrana, I think it was a group station it would be for him, wouldn't it? Yes. Who should be his aide but somebody from Chocolate and Sky? George Cunningham. Who I'd last seen at family, 10 years before now, I don't know, 5-10 years, and we had to box each other in the gym as the last sports day we had there, and he knocked me down nicely. So he was a fighter boy, actually, but he survived the Battle of Britain, because that was over then. We were sitting out in Rhodesia when the Battle of Britain went on, I hope, if my memory's right. Anyway, that was rather a nice welcome. And also, at the same time, it wasn't long before I only had... this was in... The time is February 1941 now.
Yes.
When we got to Squadron. And the Greek campaign was on.
May I just interrupt and ask, did you not have to... You had just got your wings in Rhodesia. You then sail up to the Middle East. You arrive in the Middle East right at the end of 1940, give or take.
Great.
Did you not have to do a conversion course or special training?
You see, yes. Well, I tried to make the point earlier that there was no link between wings and squadron. It became later that there was an OTU put in the middle, or night flying, or instrument flying, all sorts of things. All sorts of courses were set up on the details of flying and using the aeroplane properly, compared to what we ended up straight from wings. Useless, totally useless to the squadron. But that didn't matter, I'll tell you why. Because I only spent another 2 months. We've only got as far as April to go, to see, February to April. That's 1 month in the clear in the middle, isn't it?
Yes.
That's my squadron time, you see. Anyhow, we set off with the crew. We joined a crew. We were put in a crew. There would be two of us, UT pilots, still UT pilots, I reckon, although we were qualified, had joined the squadron, joined our boat from that squadron posting. And there was a normal crew on board, of course, of the proper crew, which is the skipper, first officer, and then there's us two who were supposed to be able to fly this airplane. But it was on ops, straight. The first trip out was an operational trip. And what our work was reconnaissance of the Mediterranean, where's the Italian forces? Have they got ships out? Is there anything going across to Tobruk that they can sink? Reconnaissance all the time. So you did about 10-hour trips out and back. More or less, not every day, but every other day, probably. The one worth mentioning as a trip was at that time the Germans in early 41, in February 41, the Germans were just starting to send their fighter forces over from Italy, which previously had only been Italian forces coming over. And that was a significant moment in the power of retaining Malta without them catching it. Well, hurricanes, probably by then, March, February. Yes, it was in April, this probably. April 41, there was no worry in England about Germans going into England, was there? There was no worry after, say, Christmas, really. They turned around and gone to Russia so that the Air Force could spare some planes. They started sending out Hurricanes to Malta. They would fly out to Gib. They'd get on an aircraft carrier, about, say, a dozen, a squadron, and have long-range tanks on. Did I say Spitfire? I hope not. They were all Hurricanes. And then they'd set off from Gib going towards Malta, and they'd go about, I think, not halfway, about 400 miles out from Gib before they'd send them off. And then the carrier would go back to Gib, where it's got all its destroyers to protect it, and the chaps flew on to Malta. And I think ours was the second trip in which we went to collect those boys from halfway to Gib and bring them into Malta. Well, that's what I put in my logbook, which is a stupid thing to put, really, because I put escorting Hurricanes to Malta. Well, they were a pretty good escort, 12 Hurricanes sitting there instead of us on our own. And that was in April 41. And I saw recently a very good painting of that done by an aviation artist who came in the hangar at Old Sarum and showed me this picture of a later delivery of Spitfires. Possibly the very first delivery of Spitfires, because they wouldn't let any Spitfires leave England till 1942, I think it was. They all stayed there. But the Hurricanes kept on coming. Yeah. And that was the only worthwhile trip I've got recorded in that period. Otherwise, all just reconnaissances. Or, going to Greece, this is the end of it now. Greece war was coming to an end. The Germans taken over from the Italians, and they'd driven out all the forces that we had put in there. So that by April the 26th, the last of the evacuations was done. The Navy had said they can't come in anymore to pick up troops or Air Force or anybody. I think that's the date. 26, 27, 28, something like that. And there was a group Captain Lee there whose job was to muster all the people together and get to some outport where there's a boat they can pinch, borrow or buy, or a merchant ship to go to the nearest island. And he managed all the offloading of people from Greece. And all the flying boats, including 230 Squadron at Alexandria. Oh, I'm sorry, we haven't gone back to Alexandria yet, have we? No. Never mind, we'll start it. We'll go back a little bit, because it is an important stage. I mentioned about the Germans coming over instead of the Italians, raiding Malta.
Yes.
Well, they were successful in one way, because they could get to Malta at low level and not be seen by the radar, and they'd come in from probably the African side rather than the Italian side, come in at dawn at low level, creep up over the cliffs and go straight through our moorings where the boats were moored and shoot them up. So 2-8 lost two boats that way, and a third one later, I think, one at Califrana and two at St. Paul's Bay, which is a very narrow bay, good place for hiding, but not from a Messerschmitt at Northfleet with 8 machine gun, no 8 cannon going, I expect, and they're out and away as they go. So it was decided, flying boats to Alexandria. So that was the second useful trip I had, because we went from Alex to went from
Malta,
Califrana, yep, to Alexandria.
Yes.
One night. I was lucky in a way, because I thought, gosh, our skipper at that time, not the one that I mentioned earlier, had been at a party in the mess at Califrana, and I think he fell down the steps, which is a lovely, beautiful mess actually, brick building, stone, everything, and he either broke a leg or something like that, and he couldn't be skipper anyway. So Henry took over, who was a second pilot with a different crew, and he was the skipper therefore. Negative. That's a little bit later. Sorry. Start again. Our skipper broke his leg, so we had to have another skipper. Our first pilot took over, flying Officer Lillian. He was a Cranmore chap too, been in the RAF about. He was an FO, a flying officer, not a pilot officer, UT. And he'd been in the RAF, I suppose, about 2 years. And he'd got a lot of time as second pilot. It's a bit like joining the Queen Mary, really. If you picture the crew of the Queen Mary, the skipper up in the thing up there, and you get in the bottom of the ladder. It's going to be a long time before you get up there. However, he took over, and I was therefore first officer. But I did the navigation on that trip. No, I wasn't flying it at all. He handled it the whole way there. We went to Crete, down to Alexandria. Night trip, that's the second useful thing I did. I'm trying to think what I was useful to the RAF for all these years of being paid. But we got there to Alexandria, all right. But then, unfortunately, there were various skippers who'd lost their boats at the other end. Henry joined us as skipper, and Lillian was second pilot again. So that's how we set off for Greece on this, where I was mentioning on the 26th or 27th, 28th of April, the evacuation is going on, and we're getting out all we can. So we were sent up there via Crete. We went to Crete, put down, refuel, off to Califrana Bay. Correction, Calamity Bay. Califrana is Malta, Kalamata, and we ought to notice this really, is Calamity Bay is at the bottom end of Greece.
Yes.
Kalamata. There's an airfield there now. And it's a flying boat base only then to go to for picking up people. And we went round various bits of Greece, picking up some from one bay on one side, some from another. And we got back quite a lot of people. There was a squadron, 228 was doing it, 230 squadron was doing it, and the Empire flying boats, which were the same thing, unarmed, but pre-war routes to Africa they operated, which our skipper who fell down the stairs had been flying on earlier. Stop.
Yes.
So waiting for us at Kalamata was Group Captain Lee with his RAF crews from the various squadrons which had been pulled back, waiting to be picked up and brought out. And during the day we got, I think, a record number up. We got 80 on board of the RAF, or 70, we're not dead sure, but it made about 90 altogether, and got them back to Crete. And off we went again, and we brought some more out from a different side of the island, That's the second trip. And then we went back to Crete for the night. And in the middle of the night, skipper was called out saying, look, you've got to go back to Kalamata again. We want to pass a message to the group captain, Lee, there, that the Navy aren't coming in anymore, or something like that. Henry thinks that's what he was sent to do. I think it was written on a bit of paper, probably, but he didn't chew it before he threw it away. because he had to keep his mouth shut where he went. And we set off.
Now, so you set off from Crete in the night?
We're still at Crete at the moment.
Yep.
He's the only person who's been ashore. Got a word from the wing commander there, whose name eludes me now, Allington perhaps, who said, look, we've got to go back in. Now, he had a great friend, Alec Frame, one of the pilots of 228 Squadron, who was very experienced indeed. He'd been there much longer, and Henry, our skipper, had been with Alec Frame a lot of the time. And Alec Frame said, you shouldn't be going on that trip, because it's night. There's nobody there to put any lights out for you. You've got to take off in the dark through Crete Harbour, which has got the battleship, the York. It was sunk in there in the harbour anyway, so there was a lot of not room for the takeoff and all sorts of things. I don't know whether Alec recommended Henry not to go or not, but he certainly said he ought not to be on that trip. He's not experienced enough. He hasn't done enough night landings, because the outcome was that we got to overhead Kalamata. Here we are sailing around in a circle, and the group captain heard us there. Why he said it was about 2 a.m, I don't know. He was waiting for us to come, I suppose, really. But there was no radio in those days. You can't talk to each other, for instance. And so I was. How many pilots do we have on board? We had the skipper, Henry, Lillian, who brought us from Alexandria to Alexandria, flying off to Lillian, and all the crew. And we got another chap called Bristow on board, who'd come aboard to go to Alexandria. And I was there. I was on the starboard, rear, amidships, Vickers gun hatch. Or was it a Lewis gun? I can't remember. All I could see, because it was quite dark, was the top of the cliffs, the quite high hills, the mountains really there, the rough coast of Greece. There's a series of rather fierce lumps, isn't it, like that sticking out. And I can see that. That's the last memory I remember of seeing anything, until I woke up in hospital there. Now, I'll tell you what happened. I don't know how Henry puts it now, except that what actually did happen. Anyway, probably what the group captain said is more important. He said he heard her flying overhead, and he heard the motors come off. And obviously he would then wait a few seconds, for a minute or two, and he'd hear the water. All he heard was a bloody great big bang. And that was all. And that was the end of us. Well, what had happened was, how shall I describe it, as to why it happened or what did happen? Well, anyhow, she came in and she knocked the bow in, obviously, and the water, if you remember that Southampton Catalina tipping over and drowning the mayor of Southampton. As soon as you get water in there, you do that. Well, we went straight over, of course.
Yes.
And in fact, the wing came off at that point, I guess, because there's more weight on the stop, and the wing stayed on the surface. Henry went through the windscreen. Lillian went through the windscreen. He must have done. He was sitting on this side. Henry's on that side. Lillian was probably had the signalling, the oldest lamp. Signalling. He probably had that, trying to show where the water is. I don't know. So he would have be thrown forward, that probably his head would be trapped in the half window. Anyhow, it turned over and they both went to the windscreen, and the ship went down and I went down, and all the crew below, most of the crew were asleep down below in the wardroom. Who came up is all that we know now, really. Henry was swimming. Bristow was up in the cockpit with Lillian and Henry. He wasn't too badly hurt. He went out after they'd broken the window for him, I think. You know, all going forward, he'd be here, he'd go out after them. And since the glass was all broken, he had a free exit. But he was fit enough to be not sent to hospital. The group captain organised some sort of fisherman to find us, I guess. And Bristow was walking about. And he got away with the group captain later. I don't know how much later. But Henry, myself, and Davies, who was the engineer, flight engineer, he was asleep down below or should have been asleep, and he got thrown up onto the you had the bombs indoors on racks at the top there. Remember when they had side doors that you sit them out on? He bashed his stomach on, or his guts on, those rather badly hurt. So he and I were in hospital, and Henry was in hospital when dawn came. I didn't come around that day at all, actually. But during that day, when dawn finally came, the group captain got away with he got a ship to take him to the next island. I think it was an island on the way out, and he got home eventually from there. So Henry was Davies and myself were the only three who stayed in German hands, because the Germans had, fortunately for them, arrived that night. It was like meeting them like that. So there was no hope of getting lifted out later by anybody. There was a VC one there. I've never read anything about it. The New Zealanders. Wonderful people, New Zealanders. Yeah. How did it happen? Well, I think there was probably one clear day when there were no Germans quite reached there. I don't know how long I was in hospital. I was operated on. But what did happen was that the army who'd been sent got pushed back there, with a lot of New Zealanders there. There were about 700 of them in a brewery, I think they were living. And this one person, this Sergeant Major, warrant officer, said, look, we're not putting up with this, because the Germans were round the camp and just about to take it, the whole thing. And so they all grabbed up all the weapons they could get, especially grenades, which we apparently were rather good at using, and charged out these frontline Germans and knocked them all out of in the town where they were. Rather like they were knocking Iraqis out if they can. And this chap, name has forgotten me now, but he sent them back so well, they got a VC that he gave them time to get more people out, but in the end they were beaten, of course, because it's at the end of a promontory, you're on your own, you're either in the water or on the land, and the German forces, of course, won that battle of Calamity Bay in the end, but only after some very brave fighting. I should think about, I don't know, 3 days later. I haven't much memory of this year. I mostly read this in this group Captain Lee's book. If you're a great book person, you might know of it. I don't know. Have a stop, shall we, and just when I came round.
Yes, well,
I didn't think it the whole of the war. It was just an accident, a pure accident.
But subsequently, you're going to tell me a story about an accident that happened to an Australian aircraft. crewed by an Australian crew anyway, which was very similar to yours, which gives a clue as to what actually happened to your aircraft.
That is so, yes.
Can you do that for me?
Can I try and do that?
Yes.
Well, I'll tell you exactly as I believe it happened, and I read about it in a book, first of all, thought, gosh, that happened to them too. And it's Chas Bauer's book, who writes about squadrons. And this Australian crew were operating out of England, as they did the whole of the war, actually, all of it, right from the very beginning, I think, with their Sunderlands. So they set off into the Atlantic to do a bit of Atlantic patrol, the usual one, looking for submarines, always submarines, or anything else that is important, I suppose. And because they were getting pretty low on fuel and they were still rather far away, the skipper thought, well, I think, Jack, we'd better put down, keep our fuel, and because we're not really sure how far we've got to go or where we are, navigating being what it is. It needs sun shots. If you haven't got any star shots or something you out there, you don't know where you are. And so they said, fair enough, we'll put it down. So they have on board flares that you can throw out to show you which way the wind's going, really, for landing. I mean, flares, the smoke, landed wind. And this amidships hatch that I was lost in earlier is somewhere where you can throw them out. Probably the tail gunner would do it. And the little float would go down. But of course, that's behind where the captain and first pilot are sitting. They're up there. This is back here, quite a long way back. So as soon as they'd flown it out and it was alight, the chap who threw it out would report, it's okay, it's alight. So they say, okay, we're going to turn and have a look at it and see how far down it is, you might say. And they went to a turn, and as they turned, the wingtip float, you know, these chaps would hang down, was in the water. And they just simply went round and sank. So they had basically what was our problem. We don't know where the water is. We're up here, there are the mountains, and that looks good and high, doesn't it? So we come around for an approach, but we don't know where the water is. I don't know, Henry was saying to himself, I don't know where the water is, because his altimeter will still be telling him what his height is above where he set off from, right? But over here, is the water at the same level as that?
Yes.
Or is the air pressure the same as at that?
Yes.
No, it isn't. It wasn't for the Australians, and it wasn't for us, because he may have been having either 300 feet on his altimeter reading, so he'll start flaring a little bit now, very slowly, but if his 300 feet is wrong, he's going in on the glide, full nose down, and
which is what?
And probably no power on. The group captain heard the power come off, didn't he? And therefore we're gliding, therefore we're coming down quite steeply, and all you have to do to put this right, to not let it happen, you've got an instrument which says rate of decline or rate of descent. Little needle goes up or down. So flying level is like that. And it wouldn't be any good him looking at that unless he knew what he was looking for on there. Because it would normally be about 500 feet a minute down in a glide. But of course he doesn't know how far it is to the water. So is he going to wait for it to hit or what? Well, if there's been a big change in height, and there had in our case, of course, and in the others, he says at 300 feet is when we hit the water. Now, there's no way of knowing that. But if you, in fact, use your instrument to, as long as you haven't actually hit the water yet, never mind, as long as there's plenty of water in front of you, never mind, just set the lowest possible rate of descent you can on that instrument, 200 feet a minute. That's 3 feet per second, isn't it? That's about that. That's not a bad rate of descent, but we're coming down at
yes.
That. But if you stay with that rate of descent, you'd be all right. There had to be some power go on, quite a lot of power to reduce the rate of descent. And you see, now our Aussies had just gone into a turn. Now they were right there already. We didn't know it. As soon as that wing went down, they were in. They had not information. We had 300 feet of information. What did his altimeter say, you see?
Yes. And so that's the reason.
It's simple, isn't it? Well, now, to solve this question finally, are we on that still?
Yes.
Doesn't matter. Into the hangar at Old Sarum comes a lot of old people, a lot of old crew, air crews, and they see somebody building something, as I am, and they say, oh, boat. Yes, I was in boats, he says. And this chap survived the war in Sunderland's. And he's about 84, and he's apparently a bit of a drinker now, and he was a bit tipsy, I thought. But I said, well, there's one thing I'd like to know from you. What did you do when you got back to your base, and you thought, how did you get on down on the deck when there's no landing lights or anything? Oh, he said, that's simple. We always had a beacon to return to. Is that a beacon, for instance? Which we didn't have then, of course, but we could see the hill, so we knew we were in them. And if you go from that point, it doesn't matter.
Bill, thank you very much for agreeing to contribute to the Imperial War Museum Sound Archive, which is very much appreciated. Can I start as I always do? Can you tell me, please, your full name and your date of birth?
I can just about remember that, yes. Leslie James Edward Goldfinch.
And your date of birth?
19th of July, 1916.
1916.
That makes me think next month isn't far away.
No, it isn't. How did you get the name Bill?
Well, I didn't tell you Bill then, did I?
No.
I think I know why. Probably because my brother called me Bill. And I can remember when I was